Hello, world. This is Allison Pipitone. In this podcast, we talk about music and those of us who do it for a song. Welcome to The Great Unsung. I have a question for you. Do you have someone in your life who, creatively speaking, maybe emotionally speaking, you're super connected with, and yet every time you're together, you argue and fight about the stupidest things? I have that connection with my brother Damon. I talked to him in Los Angeles this fall, and we had a really good conversation, and I realized that I've gotten so much inspiration from him over the years. It's sort of like we hit the ball back and forth, coast to coast. Like, he's doing this cool thing and I try to do this cool thing, and I think it's good for both of us. And he's very intuitive and he's spot on about a lot of the conclusions he comes to in life. He doesn't have the best bedside manner, which is why we probably always fight. But I enjoyed this conversation, and I hope you do too. We talked about his life now in Los Angeles, and we talked about the 1990s when we were in a band called the Monas. So sit back, relax. I hope you enjoy this episode with Damon Pipitone. Well, hello, Damon Pipitone.
Hello, Allison Pipitone.
So here I am in Los Angeles visiting you for the first time in many years. And thank you for being on my podcast.
You are very welcome.
Do you know that we're like full brother, sister? Same father, we think same mother.
Yeah, not sure. The jury's still out. We're going to do a DNA test after this.
Yeah, we're going to get $69 each and go to 21andMe. Is that what it is?
23andMe.
Oh, 23. Mine's a little cheaper. Mine's $2 less. But you don't get all the genes. There's missing some.
It's just a smattering of genes.
No, it's just a sample of the genes. All right. So I have a bunch of topics I want to talk to you about. Let's just dive right in, as they say, in the business.
In the pot. Oh, by the way, I do want to mention that I'm the first person on your podcast, although maybe it was George, who didn't pronounce it podcast. Oh my God, Allison, I'm so happy to be on your podcast.
You know, this button goes both ways. The record goes on and the record goes off. So welcome to my podcast. I have one, the first thing I want to start with is your project, Flogging Seagulls, okay? Mm-hmm. Just in like one or two sentences, tell me what is that lineup? What are you doing? What's the gig?
It's one of our singers came up with the best description of it, which really illustrates it to a live audience. He says we do 1980 songs with 1880s instruments.
And what are the 1880s instruments?
It's new wave synthesizer songs from the classic 80s era, like
the golden years of MTV,
MTV and K-Rock here in Los Angeles, KROQ. And it's, Depeche Mode and Duran Duran and Culture Club and all those kind of bands. But instead of using synthesizers and keyboards, we use traditional Irish instruments. So mandolin, fiddle, accordion, banjo, mm-hmm. and then also like a guitar, bass, and drums.
Yeah, and you said one of my singers, and I think that's an interesting thing to talk about. So obviously working in the city of working musicians, right, mm-hmm. With a larger band, 5, 6, 7 people you have, there's going to be a lot of conflicts for gigs, correct?
Yeah, the guys are in different bands. They have day jobs. They
so
have families.
What did you do? You're the band leader. Tell me what was your decision about that?
I wanted to have a core group of guys, but I also knew reality dictated that you didn't have access to them all the time. And if we wanted to play a lot, we would need, kind of either rotating guys or subs available to step in when needed. So
your band has different bandmates depending on the gig. Sometimes mm-hmm. it's one singer, sometimes it's another singer, mm-hmm. right? Are you always the drummer?
Always, yeah.
Have you ever replaced yourself yet?
I'd like to, so I can just stay home and make them do all the work.
So there's one drummer. How many different singers?
two singers, three fiddle players, and then a banjo player who also plays mandolin, and one bass player with a sub who sits in with us once in a while.
Okay.
And the two singers, an accordion player who is with us much of the time. And then the two singers also play guitar.
One thing I noticed when I went to hear you play on Friday in Long Beach was the level of musicianship with all the band members. And I want to ask you, is that a common thing in Los Angeles, or did you sort of handpick these people? Because, you know, those songs from the 80s, when you hear them, they sound so easy to listen to and simple in a way, but they're really not, they're really tricky songs. And plus, transferring them into a different version of that song, it's a lot of work. So my question is, is this common in Los Angeles that players are so good?
Yes and no. By the way, I want to mention what you said about the songs are actually more
tricky
and crafted than you would expect, because they're just usually covered in synthesizers. You just think it's guys pressing buttons. But what we learned when we stripped these songs down was, to me, in my opinion, it's the last era of actually classic songwriting, where it was a guy sat down at a piano or with a guitar.
Or a girl.
And, composed a song with a verse and a chorus and a hook, and then they translated it into the synthesizer world.
Right.
But so we learned when we broke these songs down that they're actually a lot, as you said, trickier and structured and crafted than we thought they would be. So we had to do a lot of catch up when we were learning the songs. But as far as the musicians, to answer your question, I don't know. I mean, it seems like like any city, there's good musicians and there's kind of crummy musicians. I mean, I had to convince people that this was a viable idea. And there were some people who got it who were excellent musicians, and there were some people who got it that were not so excellent musicians. And I kind of had to filter out those ones until it was never... I don't know. That sounds very cutthroat. It wasn't meant to be. I try to work with people and get them up to the level that they need to be. And if it doesn't work out, or personality conflicts or something.
Well, let's put it this way. If I had applied to audition for that band, I probably would have been filtered out, because the playing is really hard. And there's a lot of... So, yes, keep going.
I feel like in this band, the I'm the worst musician in the band by far. Everyone
and
else
that's
is
always really, that's a good goal to have, honestly.
Definitely,
right?
Yeah, it makes me kind of rise up to a level that I probably shouldn't be at, because I have to. And also as the band leader, I can't be whacking off back there. I have to be, you know.
What does that mean, whacking off?
What
does whacking off mean?
Just being a crummy drummer.
Oh, okay. I thought you were talking about something else.
Well, that's between sets.
Oh, God. All right. Another thing I wanted to say about that is your audience, your listeners, were going crazy. I think you really did a great job, and you tapped into something that's interesting. They were going apeshit, and there's no other way to say it.
Yeah. Our playlist is a different sort of 80s than what you'd expect, because a lot of 80s bands, you know, there's probably a Venn diagram where the normal 80s band will hit the same songs.
Right.
But the most 80s bands will really try to go for the hits. And by that, I mean, you know, Living on a Prayer, you know, Bon Jovi or Rick Springfield, Jesse's Girl.
That's a good song. Okay.
Yeah, those are all great songs, but there's this very specific niche that we're due. I mean, we concede, we do have a couple pop things like Cyndi Lauper, Girls Just Want to Have Fun, and some other stuff. But for the most part, we try to keep it as pure and new wave as possible.
Yeah. Okay. I like that.
And I guess to answer your question is that people aren't used to hearing those songs. They really aren't. I mean, there's no band covering... Oh, I don't know. Video Killed the Radio Star or something. I mean, sure, there's probably some out there, but
whole concept really works.
Yeah. Tainted
the whole
Love
thing. People are like, "What is going on here?" And it's like, "Oh my God, I love this." People love Irish bands and people love 80s music. Put them together. Boom. What do you got? You got Flogging Seagulls.
Yeah.
FloggingSeagulls.com, folks, right?
That's right.
FLOGGING SEAGULLS.com.
Hey.
For the Buffalo people out there, come. Okay. What is rewarding about what you do as a working musician?
There's still very satisfying to play for an appreciative crowd. And then when you do one of those gigs and people are really into it, and not even necessarily dancing, but just engaged, and you can tell that they're engaged. And, you know, I saw one guy once at a gig and, you know, it was going well, and he was rolling his eyes but smiling at the same time, meaning, I can't believe they're doing this song. I can't believe they're doing that song. He's like, oh, God. And he was making him nuts because he'd never heard bands cover these songs before.
It was a good eye roll.
Yeah, exactly.
Positive. He's so, like, does that mean that go to the right, to the left?
Well, in Australia, it goes to the left.
Oh, right. And, you know, so was he Australian?
He was in the Southern Hemisphere.
Okay.
So anyway, the an engaged crowd, whether they're partying or just watching, is still satisfying, and the money is just gravy at that point. That's kind of what makes it worth it. It's also the fact that it's a unique project, and I don't think anyone's doing what we do.
And in a larger sense, before I ask that question, do you have any bug spray out here?
Oh, I can set it up.
Let's pause it.
Yeah.
All right, we're back. In a larger sense, what motivates you? What is rewarding? I know you talked about your band, and obviously that's all true. And I guess that what I'm asking is, this field that we both choose to persevere in, right? Mm-hmm. If you look at the cost benefit analysis, right? What are the benefits and what's the cost?
The benefits, it's feeding the addiction that you want to perform music, create music. And so the benefit is that you're just able to do that.
Well, you said addiction. Do you think it's a bad thing?
No, if it's a creative addiction, I don't think so. I mean, but then you get into the bad part would be the cost, which is the schlepping, the actual financial costs, the battering of your body. I mean, getting home at 3 a.m. for 3 nights in a row could take its toll on you, especially as you age, you know, so
as you enter the prime of your life,
the golden years. so it does take its toll on you financially and otherwise, but at the same time, I mean, what are you going to do? Stop?
Right. Right. What do you can't?
Yeah, you can't.
You really can't.
I've tried.
I've tried too. I've tried a few times. Yeah. How did you try? Did you go cold turkey or did you?
I just maybe focused on other things, you know,
and then you realize there are no other things. Yeah. I mean, there are, like, you have hobbies, right?
Yeah.
Things you like, but there's one thing that you are, right?
Mm-hmm.
What I asked this to Nat and Goob, because I have a family episode I'm doing that.
Okay.
So
those are our two other sisters.
Two of our sisters, as far as we know.
Yeah.
One of them we're not so sure about. Mm. Okay, but, and we have two other brothers and one other sister.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. What was I saying?
You were talking to Nat and Goob about.
Oh, and okay. So why do you think we all, out of the first four, three of us, full on, pursued music, and Gabe's in her way did too. She was married to a musician for 20 something years and always surrounded with music. Can you tell me why do you think that happened for yourself or for all of us as a group?
It's an artist thing, I think. And it's whether you're an actor or a painter or a writer or a musician, I think there's some sort of, for the most part, I'm generalizing, but I would say it's the large percentage of them are, there's some sort of void, a black hole that needs to be filled. And it's, you know, without getting too deep into it, we're from a family of divorce, and maybe music was just that place you could go that was
taking your spaceship into the black hole.
Yeah. Define what you mean by that.
I don't know. You said black hole, and I wanted to work with that analogy.
Okay. I got to keep up with you. Sorry. Yeah, it was something that you could navigate through the black hole.
Got right? you. Yes, the navigation system.
Mm-hmm.
Music is the navigation mm-hmm. system of black holes.
Yeah, and it's weird that everyone has their own spaceship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for Goob, it's Bruce Springsteen. For Nat, it's the Georgia satellites or something.
For you, it's, I don't even want to say it, but yeah. We know it.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Beatles, of course, and the Police, and Prince, and, you know, you name it, the Kinks. You, for you, it's X, and...
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Etta James. Wait, so those are our spaceships? Yeah, Etta James. I love B.B. King, Nina Simone, right?
Okay, wait, this podcast is about me, not you.
Let me see. So when I first got my start in music, I was a young child.
Okay. So I guess my point is that our spaceships are different, but we're, you know, it manifests itself differently, but it's, mm-hmm. it's perhaps something that, and, you know, the attention that you get being on stage, I've thought about this and mm-hmm. maybe it is the attention you didn't get as a kid.
That's a good point. It's very true.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because what other job do you have where you walk in and people start clapping?
Yeah.
Right.
And you're saying, look at me. I'm doing something that's right. worth looking at and listening to. It's weird.
And I've talked to people about this in other episodes, and it's such a strange concept, isn't it? Because part of you knows, what the hell am I doing, right? I'm just standing up here with this thing, singing, and I want people to look at me.
Yeah.
Kind of weird, right?
And when you remove yourself from it, it is kind of bizarre.
Like in real life, do you want people to look at you?
No, not really.
Yeah, me neither.
No.
It would be nice if they said hello.
A top of the morning or something.
If you're in Mary, Ireland.
Or, yeah.
Or Mary Old... No, Ireland, okay. I think.
Don't want to cause
in England,
trouble.
They say, cheerio.
Yeah.
Good day. No, that's Australia.
Yeah. We're hitting the entire British
Empire.
Okay,
I'll say
the
good morning, you say where it's from. Bonjour.
Quebec.
Good one. That'll work. Buenos dias.
Guatemala.
Good. Basta.
That you just made that up.
I know.
that was the language you spoke with your imaginary friend.
Yeah, Melvin. Okay, so now I want to talk about, there's two of your albums that you made with two different projects that are probably two of my favorite albums in the world. No kidding. One of them is Dark Guitar. You made that as the Willies, right?
Mm-hmm. The most generic, I came to discover the most generic band name ever.
Can we talk about that?
How generic it was?
No, yeah, about Pittsburgh.
Oh, yeah. Well, I probably found about 12 bands called the Willies around, including one in Buffalo, by the way. I think they were they defunct at that point, though? They might not have existed anymore.
Were they funk?
Defunct.
Oh, defunct.
They could have
were
been funk.
I don't know. I don't
were
think so.
Were they a defunct funk band?
They were punk defunct funk band.
So there's maybe a dozen or so out there that I found, and I hired an attorney to file the trademark of the name.
Okay.
Which, I mean, once I found that many, I should have just come up with a different name.
Yeah, I know. But I continued. Not the persevering Pipitones.
No. You drive your spaceship right into the wall.
So, okay.
So I sent out letters of, cease and desist letters.
Yes.
And which, you know.
I'm sure that was met with great joy across the country.
Right. So a couple of the guys are really cool. Like, I don't use the name anymore, so whatever. But this one band, I think they were in Pittsburgh or something. They got really offended, as if the way they portrayed it on their website was describing me as if I was sitting by a pool in Beverly Hills, dispatching my attorney to go, harass these little bar bands.
Bring me the piss boy. Cease and desist.
But it was really just, I was trying to just legally cover.
Claim the name. And by the way, they changed their name, didn't they, as a result of that?
Do we want
to? And what did they change their name to?
I thought this was hilarious. It was, they changed their name from the Willies, and then they got my cease and desist letter, and then changed themselves to the Flaming Pipitones.
The Flaming Pipitones.
Which, I'm assuming that's some sort of, a homophobic thing, like flaming.
Or maybe they were just gay.
But also, flaming rhymes with Damon.
You were gay. Oh, Flaming Damon, yeah.
I thought maybe they were trying to, if they were smart.
The Flaming Pipitones.
Yeah.
I want to go see that band.
I may be reading too much into it. Maybe I'm giving them more credit.
I don't know if it could have been about you, because the Flaming Pipitones, I mean, that, I don't think it was about you.
if they were really smart, because at that point I didn't own my own name as a domain. They could have grabbed my name, but the .com.
I think, you know, I really have a lot of respect for that little thing that the band did. That's rock and roll right there.
Yeah.
I think we should go see their
funny.
Gig somewhere.
Yeah. I wonder if they're still performing as the Flaming Pipitones. I'd
should
be honored.
Be. The Willies. You did the Dark Guitar.
Okay.
And that is one of my favorite records, the kickoff song, Dark Guitar. I mean, did you record that on your own by yourself, or what was that like?
It's one of those projects. I had a bunch of guys on there. And I would usually just do the scratch track and then pull guys in, a bass player here.
And girls.
And girls. There are a few girls on that as well. And, you know, just whoever was available, they'd come in and usually into my bedroom. I mean, it's where everything was set up. And then, you know, I'd have a fiddle player one day and then a lead guitar guy the next day or whatever. And, you know, so... I think I played guitar and bass and drums on it too, and vocals, whatever. But yeah, it was a good group of guys.
Great album, great songs. It all starts with the songs.
Do you want me to? Are we to discuss the theme?
Well, if you want to.
It was just a. And this is kind of goes back to what we were talking about before. The Dark Guitar. It was a breakup album. It was about this long-term relationship I was in, and I got dumped.
I don't know how anyone could ever dump you, by the way.
I know. I was weeping the same thing at the time. So it just is this... I didn't want it to be just every song was super depressing, so there's some upbeat, kind of cheeky breakup songs on there and stuff like that. And the thing that... I even like came up with a concept for a musical for it because I thought it was just kind of a universal theme that would be kind of cool. Was that the Dark Guitar represented? Now that I have to give you a little more context. The itinerant life of a musician, meaning being poor, was a contributing factor to that breakup.
Yes,
and so it was almost like the thing, the poison was the cure. The guitar. Was the thing that
caused the problem
and solved the
problem. Just like your Homer Simpson poster you have inside your kitchen, which is...
Alcohol, the cause of and solution to all of life's problems.
Yes.
So I really like that irony, if that's the proper use of the word, that the guitar was the poison and the cure.
Mm-hmm. Great album.
Thank you.
Another one of my favorite all-time albums, no kidding, is Zen Boy and Karma Girl, the first one. Who We Are and How We Came to Be or something.
Who They Are and How They Came to Be, yeah.
Okay, so every single song on that record is a fucking awesome song. I love it. Every time I put it back in my car, because I luckily still have a CD player in my car, I just can't take it out. Like, I love every song on that. And I want to mention that Zadra, your girlfriend, is she Zen Boy or Karma Girl?
we're still trying to solve that mystery. But
she's Karma Girl, and you're Zen Boy.
Uh-huh, yeah,
Zen Boy. Now that's an irony.
I know, because I'm the least Zen person
you
ever
are.
Want
you're
to
like the, if you I look get, up Zen in the opposite dictionary, yeah, there's going to be you.
I'm Nez.
Yeah, Nez. I'm Nez Pipitone. I'm here to bust your bubble. The most important one I want to ask though is working with someone who is your. What do you guys call each other? Partners.
Mm-hmm.
That's. Don't you hate it when I say this is my partner? What do you have
a
business? This is my love. This is the love of my life. This is my sweetheart.
The War Department.
The War Department. Oh God! All right. So working with someone, that's a difficult thing to do. But you guys are both. You sound so good together, and her harmonies are so amazing, and it goes so well with the songs on that album.
Mm-hmm.
What's that like working together?
It was. Difficult because we have a different style of working. I tend to be very quick and curt, meaning let's get through this, try it again, you know, almost barking orders, which I totally understand could be.
I'm going to edit out the word bark, almost.
Okay. Always. Can you here? I'll give you an edit. Always. Now edit that on top of.
Always almost, yeah. Backing up with it in. Yes.
Yeah. And she's a little more flowy kind of, if it feels good, you know.
You mean so thoughtful kind.
Yeah. Like a complete opposite of me. So that can be. I'm trying. Leave me alone. I'm doing my best. You know. So she gets a little bit frustrated.
Oh, right.
But at the same time, there's a certain sound that I know she has. In fact, we always joke that my line to her always when we were recording was, she's a classically trained, awesome, beautiful operatic singer.
Mm-hmm. When she really?
Yeah, she can sing opera.
I might have to interview her next, but in Italian.
So she would be singing these beautiful lines, but I'm like, no, sing it shitty like me, because I'm not a really good singer. And
right.
I would say, no, sing it shitty like me. And we always joke about that.
Oh, I got you. Okay.
Because the sound.
They wouldn't gel if it was stylistically so different.
Exactly. And, okay. and the sound I was going for was, I mean, the easy place to go is like Simon and Garfunkel. But even, you know, our Garfunkel is one of the most angelic voices on the planet. So
yes.
That wouldn't be I wanted it to be a little more raw.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a style, and I don't even know what you would call it. It was probably the folk era, early 60s folk, where the girl would be singing the melody on top, and then the guy would be harmonizing underneath, as opposed to Simon.
Was that like Ian and Sylvia?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Good call.
Oh, I forgot about them. They're really good.
Yeah, and like the, you know, I'm trying to think of other, maybe we'll edit in other people we think of later, but it's, as opposed to Simon Garfunkel.
Won't. We're not going to edit anything.
Create more work for Al. The Simon and Garfunkel would be, Paul would be singing the low harmony and Art would be harmonizing on top. Mm-hmm. So that's why it also was not a very accurate comparison. But I love the sound of the female voice on top and the male harmonizing underneath.
Right.
So that's
for
the most part what Zen Boy and Karma
were. Oh, that's
work.
Cool. Do you need to take a break so you can
yes, please.
Clear your throat? Okay. 5 seconds. 5, 3, 2, 1.
I did 3 shows in a row for the last couple of days.
Yeah.
And so my voice is shot.
I know. That's a tough one,
mm-hmm.
right?
It takes its toll.
And then they have family in town. That's on top of all that.
That's the real
that's
burden.
The one, that's the kicker right there. Are we done talking about Zen Boy and Karma Girl? You guys
yep.
had some really cool, I love the album. I really encourage everyone to go find it and listen to it. Is it on YouTube?
Yeah, it's on iTunes. And I've got probably 800 CDs if anyone wants one.
Right. Just pay postage and handling, or we'll just drive it over to your house.
Yeah,
drop
right.
it in your. We should do like a paper route with Zen Boy and Karma Girl and just throw them like from our bike in the old days. Okay. Actually, a couple more questions, and I know you want to talk about another project we had together.
Yes.
I want to talk to you about this concept, big fish, little pond, big pond, little fish, right? I live in Buffalo, New York.
Mm-hmm. I'm familiar with it.
You live in Los Angeles,
California.
And it's such a different experience to be living and performing and working in each of those places, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I sometimes feel like, oh man, should I have stayed in LA? I do sometimes feel like that. I love Buffalo. People have been so good to me, so nice to me. I've had a great, actually, career for 20 years. But I really feel sometimes like, I wonder if I should have stayed in LA. What is it like to be here?
It's Los Angeles itself, the city, the county, for the most part. I mean, Hollywood, for instance, is where a lot of the venues are, the live music venues. It's pretty dead. And by that, I mean, it's an industry town. I don't feel like anyone in the industry, whether it's the music industry or the TV industry or the mm-hmm. movie or whatever, is really all that interested in going out and seeing live events, whether it's music or otherwise. They're kind of like, this their day job, you
right.
know?
Yeah.
There may be a scene in Silver Lake. It's hard for me to say these days because I haven't done original music or at least live performing of original music for
right.
a long time.
Right.
But even in a cover band, which is what Flogging Seagulls is, it's just really hard to find a thriving music venue in the city of Los Angeles.
Right. It's okay.
Sorry about that. And it, you know, So we have to leave town. We have to go down to Long Beach or Orange County.
Okay.
And you know, area like Venice, I mean, it's almost, there's this weird energy near the beach.
Mm-hmm.
The closer you get to the coast, the more energized.
The more people like your music.
Yeah. And they like to party. You always get the best dancing crowds
right.
at the beach venues. I don't have an explanation for that. It just seems to be true.
Right.
You and I, and we'll discuss this later, know what it's like to be a passionate original artist in Los Angeles.
Yes.
It's tough. And it's a lot of pay to play. I don't even know if we need to explain what that is.
Probably not.
Basically, just one version of it is you pre-buy the tickets yourself. So the club guarantees they make their $300 or $500 or something.
Right.
And then you have to go sell them to your friends or just give them to your friends.
Right.
It's just an investment to have people show up. That gets tedious and expensive.
Right.
It's just a kind of...
What's good about it, doing it here?
That's my home. That's where I live.
Right. Which, speaking of home, okay, you have a beautiful home. I'm looking at the most awesome view of Los Angeles right now. 3 years ago, you guys bought this house. Wasn't that a statement about, like, all right, things are not that bad, right? Because I own a kick-ass house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's... If I'm being brutally frank with you and myself and everyone around me...
And the 10 people who are listening to
yes.
this.
Hi, guys. This would not be possible without the War Department. You know, it's like that old joke.
Also known as your love.
Yes, the love of my life. the old joke about the... What do you call a drummer who breaks up with his girlfriend?
What?
Homeless.
Yes.
You know, so... A lot of this is just being in a great partnership, and we were able to get this money pit of a house that we're in the process of fixing up. You know, it's very difficult to buy real estate in Los Angeles now. We got in very lucky. Just the mm-hmm. timing was a pure, sheer luck. I know nothing about real estate. This mm-hmm. was just a hunch, and we bit. You know,
mm-hmm.
so it's I guess the.
When you say a hunch, did you guys like wear trench coats and
we
bowlers?
Snuck in.
And you,
yeah,
you just...
we crouched under the window. And...
Hey, Cassandra, I got a hunch. Let's go up on Richard Circle. But isn't it so cool to own a house finally? And like, doesn't it feel good?
Yes, it's a strange feeling because you don't ever expect it. You know, what you think is, okay, I'm going to go from this crappy little apartment, and then maybe you know. You're going to get a huge advance from a record company, and then you'll be living in Bel Air.
Right.
You're going to go from this squatting in an apartment right. to a right. mansion. Right.
And that keeps you fueled for about 10 or 15 years, yeah. right? Like, oh, mate, just in a couple more weeks, I'm going to get that call, and that it's going to lead right to Bel Air.
Yeah, exactly. So this is a strange feeling to not have people living on top of you.
Right.
You know, in an apartment.
Right. Let's take a quick little break and then we're going to talk about the Monas.
Oh, no.
All right, we're back. Los Angeles, 1987 or 88. When did we start the Monas?
I'm going to say 86 because I was still in high school.
All right, let's talk about that. What do you think?
About the Monas?
Yeah.
I think it was a good band of fakers. We didn't really know what we were doing. We just had raw kid energy.
Right.
Young person energy and just passion. And you and I have discussed this before, and I think I even discussed this with Aaron, who is our bass player, since then. We missed, there was a window for a band like ours, and we missed it. There was one before us and one after us. And because of the time we broke up, we just missed both of them. I mean, in other words, we were too young for the first one, which was the LA punk scene, which spawned X.
Right. That was like maybe, what, 10 years before us?
I'd say so. Were we
a punk band, though?
We had punk energy, and you had a really crunchy guitar sound. It was a very distinctive.
Oh, yes, I did.
That SG.
Plus, no guitar solos, so
yeah.
That's punkish.
Oh yeah, it was very Ramones.
Right.
If you wanted to do the easy comparison, you would say we were. I always think we were like if you crossed the Ramones with the Go-Go's
because
we had female singers and we wrote pop songs, but with a very crunchy punky edge.
Right.
And maybe more diverse than we give ourselves credit for, because it wasn't just like thrashing punk the entire time.
Right.
We could stop down and do a ballad and things like that. But so the post Mona's window that we missed was the female led grunge. I mean, there was grunge. We coexisted in the grunge era.
Yeah.
And then it led into a female led, like Courtney Love and Hole and L7 and even like Garbage. I think they're a little more electronic, but they're still kind of a little punk. And so that was probably about 4 years after we broke up or something.
You know, it's kind of funny. I remember thinking back then, like, so when we were a trio, me and you and Aaron, after Nat had moved to Colorado, I remember feeling like, you know what? We could really make, something's going to happen, right? I felt like that. And we got like, didn't we get a development deal with like, didn't we? We got a development deal right near the end.
A guy was offering us something that was really one-sided, and our friend Jim Bailey advised us not to sign it. And he was very astute. He's way more experienced in the music industry than we were. And he said, you guys are going to lose your publishing and stuff if you sign this.
And we told the guy,
he was trying to butter us up by taking us out for drinks and getting us to sign this contract. I even have a vague recollection, and Aaron might back this up, and you might remember too, that he had chicks with him to make him look a little more, he had like young girls.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I remember nothing about any of that, 100%. And I think the thing is, I was having so many personal problems at that point that I literally feel
you were on
like,
autopilot, right?
Yeah. My spaceship into the black hole was on autopilot. And I feel like something bad would have happened to me if I kept that up. We were around a lot of things, like a lot of, you know what I mean? Like the drugs and our manager and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And we were good. We were always pretty
clean.
Yeah. But I remember feeling this could be the end of me, really. Mm. And I felt like, I was like, you know, something could happen with us. So anyways, we had so many, it was an exciting time though, wasn't it?
It was progressing. I felt like you said, that development, and that wasn't going to go anywhere, but it just, the notion that someone felt like we had enough potential to want to sign us or something like that.
We had that many times though. Do you remember Rhino Records? The owner of Rhino Records called me up when I was at work at Advocate Investigations. Mm. And he said, I got to tell you guys, I got your demo. I love it. It was a Friday. He's like, I just have to talk to my partner, who's the co-owner, and I'm going to call you guys on Monday. Guess what? The partner didn't like us.
Okay.
So we have like about 20 stories like
okay.
that.
That's some of them I forgot too. So it's good that we can.
Were you on autopilot?
Yes. So where were we? What were we talking about with the Monas here?
How we were good. How we had a lot of fun stories.
I do want to say this, and before I forget, because this is probably
gonna
apropos
be,
of nothing.
Going to be but, edited out.
Yeah. But, and correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, maybe your experience is different, but Aaron and I discussed this, and I realized that the only band I've been in that laid down the rhythm tracks, meaning the guitar, bass, and drums, from the start to finish with no overdubs and no click track was the Monas. Ever since then, it's been that kind of, you know, Lego blocks where you have the click and the drummer does his thing and the scratch.
Yeah.
And it's you know, I have not been in a band since then that, and I've been in a lot of bands since then. It's all been that just kind of layering process. Not to say that the Monas didn't overdub vocals and guitar licks on top of what we did, but if you listen to, I think, any Mona song, there's no click track, and the three main instruments, the rhythm guitar, the bass, and the drums, are playing live in the studio.
Yeah. That's the only way we knew how to do it.
Yeah.
We didn't know what the hell we were doing.
That's right.
And yes, you're right. But I was just talking to George about that when we had his interview. That creates something. When you record live, all the instruments live, it becomes alive. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So there's like that, it captured the energy. And I agree with you. There was an energy that was captured. I learned everything about music with that band. Everything. We really went from nothing, starting bare bones. We had to buy instruments. We were like, who's going to play what? Played like the worst possible gigs you could ever play, like, and we worked our way up to like to the point that we were playing at the Troubadour, the Roxy, the Whiskey, right?
We ended up getting a really juicy residency up in Pasadena, too, which was every month we'd play there. Remember the Old Town Pub?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Where David Lee Roth came in.
Yes. He signed my guitar. Signed I remember it. That.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had a lot of stories. And so we were part of a scene. That's kind of cool, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's kind of cool to be part of something that you always have that you're like, oh, my God, that was
Well, when
really
you say
cool.
part of a scene, it was our own scene. I mean, we weren't friends with other bands or anything. No one invited us to, hey, Mona's, come be on our show. I mean, we were pretty... I don't remember. Yeah.
Yeah, you're right.
It was our own,
we weren't part of a scene.
Yeah, it was our own scene.
We weren't, yeah. Collaborating. I can tell you one thing. That's the only time I've ever collaborated songwriting with somebody.
I was going to say the exact same thing. I've tried writing songs with other people. It never, I mean, unless they're just jokey, stupid, funny songs, you know, real songs. And you and I, like, sat down, you know, just shoulder to shoulder with two guitars and wrote, I'd say a good half dozen or dozen songs or
yeah.
something.
We actually did that yesterday on our vacation and we published that.
Are you
going to
tell that story?
No. Yeah. Okay.
Let them find it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Just Google Scarborough Unfair. There was no alcohol involved in that whatsoever.
What? Are we done talking about the Monas?
No,
do you want to say anything else?
I thought we were heading towards something with it.
Well, I have a separate question to ask you.
Oh, collaborating. Okay, the songwriting thing, first of all. And also just the coexisting with band. Like, that was rough. I mean, almost the same way that that when you're with your romantic partner in a band, like, other weird emotional layers are going to come into the collaboration. Yeah. It's hard enough to collaborate with musicians just in general.
Well, you know, one thing I think that we did was really good was we rehearsed a ton.
Yes.
Didn't we, like... three times a week?
At least twice. I mean, we used to go down to Whittier, mm-hmm. which if you want to pull out, we'll wait while you pull out a map
go
of
ahead.
Southern California.
People scroll. Well, tell them where we were living.
Yeah, we were in
South Pasadena,
and we would drive down to Whittier.
It's,
yeah, and it was you know, probably during rush hour traffic or something, which is a nightmare.
So it was a good 50-minute drive.
Yeah, and we would. A friend of ours was a caretaker in an old bank building that was being. It was actually Richard Nixon's first law office. Mm-hmm. There's a plaque outside that said that. Mm-hmm. And our friend was a caretaker and lived in the basement. He was like, I don't know, like Schneider from One Day at a Time,
but
or something.
A lot better looking.
Yeah,
he was kind of hunky.
He was dreamy. Yes,
dreamy Rick.
He let us go into one of the vaults. We would actually rehearse in a vault, you'd slide open that giant metal door to go in, and mm-hmm. our drums and amps yep. would be set up in there and everything. And it was awesome. But we would do the same 10 songs. It was not like we had, once in a while we'd learn new songs, of course, but we would just rehearse the same 10 songs.
I know.
Like, why?
I know. Why did we do that?
When I realize how much I and my fellow musicians hate rehearsing, it boggles my mind that we would do the same. And by the way, these were songs that we'd been playing for years. It wasn't like.
We must have liked it.
Yeah, we must have.
Yeah. I mean. It worked. I mean, we were really good. We were super tight.
We were talking about the collaboration, though. When you're in a band with family members, I mean, you hear the stories about the Kinks or the Oasis.
Oasis.
The Gallagher Brothers or, you know, you name it.
You have to choose at some point. Do I want a band or do
or
I want to keep my family? We chose family over band.
Right. But, I mean, talk about the diplomacy I employ now in bands after having been in that. First of all, we were super young and mm-hmm. I had no way of navigating or diplomatically solving problems.
Yeah, there's no
in a
diplomacy.
Band. Yeah. And also it was one of those democracy bands where we all had an opinion, you know, like the Alison Bibitone band is there's one benevolent
That's
dictator.
That's not true. I don't know. Yeah, I guess. So. Okay.
Yeah.
I'll accept that because you said the word benevolent. I don't like dictator. Like, it's not really like that, but
that's why you put the benevolent descriptor.
Is there
on
such
it.
A thing as a benevolent dictator?
Its name is Alison Pippitone.
No. There's no such a thing. All right. So, anyways, back to Whittier.
I was just saying that it's collaborating. I learned so much of what to do and what not to do. Another thing I learned from that band. Was that I was a very busy drummer.
Okay.
Because I went from being a drummer in that band to a lead singer guitar player who wrote the songs and
right.
kind of had an idea how I wanted them arranged.
Right.
And I would tell all the drummers, don't be so busy. And then, so when I went back to playing drums, I became a much more straightforward drummer based on that experience.
I get that. But I would say in the Monas, M-O-N-A-S, mm-hmm. in the Monas.
By the way, there's another Monas out there.
I'm going to sue their ass. We're going to send them a letter. And they'll be called the
Flaming Monas or something.
I was only going to say that in that band, the Monas, a busy drummer was a good thing.
Yeah, not that I would put myself on the same level as the monster genius Keith Moon, but there was a very Who Junior element to our band. It was very busy bass player Aaron. He would admit that I was a busy drummer like Keith Moon, and you were like the Keith. I'm sorry, the Pete Townsend.
Really?
Strumming the do you hate the Who or something?
I won't say hate, but
they're one of the
on the top 10 records that you would not take on a desert island.
It would be what, like the Who's Who, next?
Every Who record.
Well, but you cannot like their music, but appreciate what they, especially yes. live, watching them live and going the sound that was coming out of those three guys, and then Roger Daltrey on top.
Right.
So okay. and Pete was doing just a lot of chunking away on the chords, which what you did.
Yes. Okay, I'll accept that analogy.
Yeah. So, but going back to your point, in the Who it worked, and I think in the Monas it worked. Mm-hmm. By the way, everybody, I'm not comparing this to the Who. We weren't as good as the Who.
Most of the people listening, all 10 of them, they might not even know who the Who is. I think times are changing, Damon.
Okay. They might go, the Who?
Yeah.
Thank you.
One more question that I know of, which I just forgot what it is. Wait.
Should you rewind?
Oh, here it is.
Yeah.
What advice would you give to young people who are really passionate about pursuing a career in music? Seriously, because I think there's a lot of wisdom that you can impart, you know, from having done this for so long.
In the modern era, you need to wear many hats. And by that, I mean, you can't just expect to, no matter how brilliant of a guitar player or singer you are, something that's not enough. You have to be able to make videos or at least edit videos and do your social media, book your own shows. Oh, it used to be other people used to do that for you when you were a musician.
I know.
You know,
what the
you could
hell?
Just bang groupies and snort coke and then show up at the. Yeah, I did that all the time.
Oh, brother!
Back in the 70s. When I was in Mata Hoople.
Yeah, you went from diapers to hookers, right?
but you have to do everything for a while. Hopefully, you'll get it to the point where you can start handing those jobs off to other people because there's enough money to go around that you can hire a manager and a social media
person. So you're right. Yeah, that's a good point. What you're saying is you have to do everything.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a do-it-yourselfer, if you want to have a career off of music, it's not just good enough to write the song.
Right. And I also say be as unique as you can. You're allowed to have influences, but
I say be yourself as much as possible.
Yeah.
Find your unique fingerprint of what you do, right?
Right, yeah. And speaking of having diversifying, if you have the propensity to play more than one instrument, I bet you you're going to open up a whole world of opportunities. Let's say you started playing trumpet in the high school band, and then you moved over guitar because you got into rock after that.
Bob Seger, let's just say you got into Bob Seger,
so
you put down the trumpet and picked up the guitar. Okay,
and you had those night moves,
right?
Don't let those trumpet skills go. See if you can, because you can get gigs. I mean, I would say a trumpet player is way more valuable than a guitar player. Mm-hmm. I hate to break it to you, six string maniacs, but
six string slingers.
But you're a dime a dozen. A really good like upright bass player or mm-hmm. a fiddle player is you're gonna never stop working if you can do that. So, and if you're a guitar player, maybe invest in an upright bass. And I guarantee you're going to get more gigs doing that than you will as a guitar player. Mm-hmm. Don't stop playing guitar. Do them both.
Right. Good. All right. I think we can wrap this up.
Thank Christ.
I'm going to edit that out because we can't use the Lord's name in vain. Because what if our sister listens to this?
It wasn't in vain. I was really thanking Christ.
Nope. It's out.
He just walked in and handed me a beer.
It's out.
I was thanking him.
It's out. All right. Let's go to dinner.
Yes.
We'll be right back.
I want to end this episode with a story about my brother's best friend in high school named Alec Berg. He was also Aaron's best friend, who is the bass player in the Monas. So picture three guys just doing everything together throughout high school and super talented kids. Alec was an amazing actor. He played the saxophone. He was super funny. Anyways, two parts to this story. Part one, I was living in Los Angeles and I was driving home with my friends Eric and Mary, and we were driving on the Hollywood freeway, and we saw this person step out of the bushes towards the freeway, dressed in white, and it was like red on the side of his shirt. And it was like a moment where we couldn't believe what we were seeing. We got off the next exit, which was near my house, went home, called the police, and hoped that someone came out to check out this person. So it turns out it was actually my brother's best friend, Alec, that had been in a car accident. The car went off the side of the road, and he went down like an embankment. He climbed up to the freeway just when we were driving by. So I felt this terrible guilt. I was like, oh my gosh, why didn't I pull over? If I had known it was Alec, I would have. Anyways, he was okay from that accident. And I was inspired to write a song. I wrote some lyrics to a song and the Monas sang it. It's called Alec's Night Out. And I'm going to play it for you. But I remember we played the song a bunch of times out. And I know Alec came to hear us. He broke his arm that night, I think. And he had a cast for a while. And so that song was kind of cool for us to sort of remember that moment. So anyways, fast forward a couple of months, I believe, and Alec was driving up to San Francisco, and he was actually killed in a car accident. And I remember at that moment that I looked back on the song that I had written, and it was just made it doubly difficult. So the Monas, it was a great era with an amazing bunch of people. Alec Berg had so much to contribute to this world. I sure wish he would have lived through these decades and been with us. And so as an homage to the Monas and Alec, I'm going to finish this episode off with a song called Alec's Night Out. Thanks, guys, and I'll talk to you very soon.